Thank you, Yi. Great to be here. Thank you very much. Let's see if I can get my slides to work. Oh, that's not my slides. Here we go. So I'm going to look at a number of trends that are both exciting and somewhat ominous in security through this presentation. If I sort of step back and very quickly sort of look at my career, though, I started out looking at algorithms, and I was really excited originally that we could solve our security problems with algorithms, and then discovered that that wasn't where the problem was, and started looking at protocols, worked on protocols like SSL, and then discovered how badly the software implementations were bollocksing everything up. Spent a while looking at how to do software better, and eventually realized that there were more people learning, they were entering the field of writing software than were even taking computer security classes. So my little teacup really couldn't bail out the ocean. And in the last decade, I've been really focused on what we can do in hardware. And hardware is really neat because there's nothing that sits underneath you. And as I talk through this presentation, I'm going to be tying a lot of the problems that we're seeing today in computer security back to the hardware problems that this group is really focused on. I'm going to start out with an optimistic slide, but don't get your hopes up. These are some of the sort of old crypto, I collect old crypto gear. I think it's fascinating what you can do with sheet metal and Bakelite and mechanical systems to do computation. And it turns out that one of the things you quickly realize when you look at these old crypto systems is that they were starved for computation. And as you got more ability to compute when you were encrypting your message, things got a lot stronger. So as you went to things like the Enigma machine from just manual hand ciphers, things got a lot better. And you can see that trend even continuing, at least till fairly recently, from a mathematical perspective. For example, you take single DES and you go to triple DES, 3 times the effort to do your encryption, 2 to the 56 times more work for the person trying to break it. So you would think, based on this, that we ought to be getting exponential improvements in security that would just be absolutely wonderful. But that is not the world that we live in today. No matter how you really measure the state of security, it looks pretty bad. Breaches are happening at increasing paces, the severity is growing, and the number of devices is growing. So really there are these three trends that are driving the technology industry. And if you're a company making devices, these are the things that are why your stock price has hopefully been going up, where profits are coming from. You've got more devices, excellent. You've got more valuable data on those devices, excellent. And you're able to put more and more features into those devices. But now we're going to go put our security hat on, and that really just means 3 things. We have more targets, more reward when we break something, and we have more vulnerabilities to exploit in those things that we want to break. So we have these 3 exponential trends that are fueling insecurity and not really any balancing trends that are able to keep up with these. And this is the sort of general landscape that we've been dealing with for the past years and are going to continue dealing with for a while. And this is the world that we have to operate in. So the first question to ask then is, why is this is really, in many ways, it's the complexity problem. But what happens when we add complexity to a system, especially if we do it in a not very well thought through, non-security centric perspective? So one way to simply look at this is, okay, if I take my code base and I make it twice as big, if I've got an equal flaw density, what's the chance that I got all the bugs out? So I go from 100 lines of code to 200 lines of code. Well, I square my probability of success. So if I started with a 1 in 5 chance, I now have a 1 in 5 squared chance. That's not good. That means that my odds of getting the bugs out rapidly approach zero. And in reality, it's actually worse than that, because if I have twice as much code but the same amount of time to work on it, the amount of attention I can give per line of code goes down, so my defect densities go up. And also, in the findings that when we look at causes of failure, it's usually about an unexpected interaction that occurs between components. And again, if you don't constrain things, the number of interactions goes up much faster than linearly as the complexity increases. So again, all bad stuff here from a security perspective. So this was a bridge built in Ohio in 1924. This is a security talk, so I bet all of you know what happened to this bridge. It collapsed. And it collapsed because of a design philosophy that was taken, which was one where there were individual components that had to be, that the integrity of the bridge depended on. And when one of these failed, the bridge came down. So if you ask the question then, okay, let's look at this from a single point of failure perspective, how many of these fracture critical elements, that's the structural engineer term for these things, are there in, say, a typical connected device today? And it turns out that, you know, if I can control or stick a bit of DRAM, I can probably get a security critical structure located there. Most of the transistors in the CPU, or at least a large number of them, are security critical, it turns out. And you can go through and look at this. And if you look at a current device, we're at around 10 billion fracture critical components right now. Now, they have a pretty low failure rate individually, but when you multiply across 10 billion components, that's a very complicated problem to understand. And in about 10 years from now, we're going to be around a trillion of these. So the failure rates that might be acceptable now, if you even consider today's situation acceptable, will not be acceptable 10 years from today. So one way to think about our security problem is to look at it as sort of like a fractal. So here's the Mandelbrot set, and you can zoom in and zoom in, and sort of buried there, and I sort of cheated and stuck a little bug in there. You know, you go way deep in there, and you can see an individual bug, like, you know, I have the magnifying glass, like a go-to fail from Apple there. And when you stare directly at them, it, you know, makes a lot of sense. You can see the bug in the upper right there. But when you step back again, you can also see the overall risks if you think about it in the right way. But if you're thinking at this sort of very, very zoomed out level about I am perfect unless I have a hidden bug somewhere and I just got to find that bug and I'm good, you're going to miss the overall risk profile of the system. So our brains trick us here. We have this idea that if we understand, for example, a low-level component, like I have a pretty good understanding of what a transistor does. And I understand how transistors go to processors. I mean, I actually think I understand probably all of the steps in between. Yet this intuition that because I understand transistors that I understand microprocessors is really wrong. And when I go from the processor to the machine language, that's, again, there's a whole new set of complexity that comes in that my brain is tricking me to thinking that I understand the security risks of the machine language because I understand what the transistors are. And then I look at something like an operating system like Windows, and a whole new set of issues come into place. And you go from one device to a network, and we try to build these secure services that people's everyday privacy depends on out of these things, and this intuition causes us trouble. So, you know, you look at the Ashley Madison hack, and you're trying to figure out, okay, why does this, quote, secure service fail, and what are the consequences? Well, people, you can sort of trace a lot of these things back to, ultimately, this complexity problem. So we make these incorrect assumptions, and I'm going to give two examples of them. One is this assumption that lots of people make even though they know it's wrong, which is that a ton of software will be bug-free. You know, I'm writing my security application, and because I want customers to use it, it's going to run on some big operating system, yet my security depends entirely on that operating system, and my assumption here is wrong. And you look at the reality. Almost any device you've got is 1 to 3 bugs away from absolutely completely being breached. I mean, everything gone. So in the best case, an attacker might have to find a browser bug followed by an OS bug followed by a TEE bug. Now, in reality, very few devices actually even have TEEs, so usually you're 1 or 2 bugs away from total compromise. And each of those layers is large enough and complex enough that there is effectively certainty that there are catastrophic bugs in them. If anybody wants to take a private bet with me about whether there's a bug in Windows, come up afterwards and I'll tell me your odds. I'm up for that. Another example of a completely incorrect assumption is that the one that cryptographers love to make, which is that the attacker will only see the binary data coming back and forth that's part of the protocol that was written in the specification. And in reality, there's all kinds of stuff that attackers can get access to. One problem that I've spent a number of years working on is this problem of side channels, where you have RF emissions coming out of devices that are very, very loosely correlated to things that are happening inside the crypto. But even the effect of a single wire or transistor in a giant SoC, say as part of your phone, can let you pull the keys out of your device from just outside the case. And the crypto was built on the assumption that there were absolutely no correlations being revealed other than the things to the input message and the output message, but you give me a little tiny weak correlation in the middle and everything comes crashing down because that assumption was off slightly. And there's optimism here. I mean, we've got 9+ billion chips being made a year that have countermeasures to this. So, I mean, it's happening, but the wrong assumptions, again, keep getting made because new people come in and make the same mistakes that everybody else made before. So if we want to start tackling this risk problem, there are four properties that a solution has to have, I believe, to be successful. And one is it has to be anchored in hardware. We've spent many, many, many years, decades, hoping, perhaps in vain, that the last software bug would get found and somehow software security would be a solved problem. I've given up on that. I don't think we're going to find large code bases of software that do useful things that are bug-free. So if we want to be able to build reliable security boundaries, we can't build boundaries between pieces of complex software. We have to build them anchored down in the hardware. The second property is that whatever we're doing has to be deployable additively. Because if you go to somebody who has a great profitable business based on current insecure complex stuff and say, go throw away what's making you profitable and go put this different thing in, they're not going to do it. And if you go to people who aren't making any money and ask them to go do something, the likelihood is going to get widely deployed is essentially zero. So you have to have a way you can go to somebody and say, here's your current risk profile, add this thing in, and your risk changes in a way that is measurably beneficial. And you can add something onto what you've got today. The third property is you have to address the infrastructure. You can't just say, oh, here's a wonderful thing to put in your device. You have to figure out how it got keyed, how it got deployed, how it got managed through testing and manufacturing, and what happens at wafer sort, what happens at package test, what happens at device assembly, what happens when the carrier activates your phone, what happens when the person sells the thing on eBay. And there's infrastructure to enable a lot of this. Now, it may not be trusted infrastructure, but there's still infrastructure to enable it all. So you don't want it to necessarily see your keys, but if you can't make this stuff actually happen in the real world, it ends up being a science project rather than something that users use. And the last problem is one that you have to really solve the economic issue. You have to make it something where each of the stakeholders is at least ambivalent about it, and better yet, has some kind of profit motive for doing what you want. So if you put in a certification process that slows somebody's product getting to market by 6 months, and doesn't increase their sales, well, that's not going to have a broadly positive ROI. But something where you can go to somebody and say, look, you're managing 500 configurations of your chip because you charge different prices for these flavors of them. If you add a security block in here, oh yeah, it'll protect the user's keys, but it will also mean that you can activate your chip in the device assembly with the particular configuration they want. They go, oh, that's going to save me a bunch of money. That's going to save me more money than the cost of this. And they're suddenly going to be a lot more receptive to what you're doing. So another part of the problem here that comes from what I just described is about trying to add things. We have to think about security perimeters very carefully. And the traditional approach to security, this is the Intel philosophy, we just pile more and more stuff into our chip and hope that there's no bug anywhere in the chip and probably no bug anywhere in the entire PC, doesn't scale. If you put more and more complexity into the same perimeter, you eventually have your probability of security decreasing to zero. Microsoft's largely done the same thing, or at least got a critical perimeter that's too big. And so that the approach that you see with well thought through storage of ammunition matches fairly closely to what we need for cryptographic secrets and other sensitive operations. So on the left here is a Serbian ammunition storage facility. This picture was taken before it exploded. On the right is the Black Hills Ordnance Depot, where you can see from a satellite view that there are lots of little tiny bunkers that are or buildings that are each storing a smaller quantity of munitions. And if one individual building goes off, it doesn't mean that the entire security or the entire that you don't lose everything all at once. Whereas if you pack everything together, when one thing goes, one single point of failure goes, everything in your entire system falls apart. And when the value of that system is growing exponentially, it's a really, really bad thing. So we've talked about software security not being scalable here. And that problem is going to keep getting worse, not better. And there are some things that people have tried to do. We have Trust Zone, we have Ring Zero, there's process separation. But those really haven't helped despite decades of trying, or maybe they've helped provide a single constant improvement, but that's not been able to keep up with the exponential increases in the scope of the problem that needs to be solved. This one's a little more controversial to this audience, but I don't think that separate chips and modules solve a large class of the problems. They work great for a small subset of the problems, but they really don't have the security in the place where you need it, and they're too expensive. So when you for example, if I've got a secure thing over there and my data is here, that separate chip connected by an interface that is potentially not trusted doesn't necessarily do me a lot of good, and I can try to put security here and there and encrypt the channel and make sort of complicated things, but they have not really addressed the problems that we have today, and I don't think they're going to. Doesn't mean there's not a very important subset of problems where they're needed, but they're not the general purpose solution. So the area that I'm most optimistic about is actually changing the way we build our complex SoCs and putting security blocks and processors and hardware into those devices, integrated with the functionality that they perform, to provide, instead of a chip with one large security perimeter, many, many internal security perimeters within the design. And those can be separated from each other so that the security blocks don't depend on the SoC fabric, the DRAM, the main processors, and so forth for security. So why is this important? One is that this integration gives you big security advantages. I can get high performance, low power, things that I can't do well with a separate chip. The other part that's even more important is the economics. When I put something inside the die, it becomes a lot cheaper. There's not a separate package to pay for. Manufacturing costs, or the cost of the logic, falls 10 to 100x, and that will actually keep increasing over something that requires a separate physical component. So we can get much, much greater reach than we can get with, for example, separate things or separate chip packages, despite some places where it's more complicated, like the economics of certification are certainly an issue that a lot of you are thinking about, but and become a lot harder when you put security into a big, complicated thing, because holding up the security chip for 6 months while it's certified is one thing. Holding up all of the functionality in a big SoC for 6 months means the impact or cost there is dramatically greater. So trying to figure out ways to deal with problems like certification are absolutely critical for us to be able to tackle some of these security challenges. Other problems are quite solvable. So we figured out how to build digital countermeasures that can substitute for analog ones using OTP instead of NVM, because you don't have rewritable memories on SoC design, manufacturing processes usually. You know, factory situations where instead of having a trusted factory with an armed guard at the door, which actually hasn't worked very well if we look at the Gemalto NSA experience, replacing that with something where you build a secure tunnel between the core and the chip and a programming infrastructure appliance, and getting third-party vendors to tackle the engineering so chip makers don't have to. These have all proven themselves quite solvable. So if we do this, the reason this approach, though, I'm so excited about is that it really takes Moore's Law and in a sort of rare way, turns it in a way where it can help security instead of hurt security. So as we get cheaper transistors, the cost of putting extra transistors for security falls. And if we look at the analogy of the number of CPUs that are going into your mobile device, I mean, you've got 4 to 8 to 16 processors of kind of the big ARM cores in your mobile phone, and there are dozens of other little processors in there. So the cost of putting in the extra functionality, the extra transistors to do security, is largely immaterial today. And if anybody has a concern about that, in 18 months to 2 years, it'll be half that. So again, it's just a matter of time before these technologies can be put in, and we have the potential even to have many, many security modules within a given chip. There's no reason we can't have different ones for VPN and payments and different use cases. From my company or division's perspective, we've been building security cores to deal with different kinds of problems for a long time. And one of the things that we realized a few years ago is that the companies building chips actually had multiple problems. One is they had to have better solutions inside their chips, and we've built a variety of those. I'm not going to talk about them today. As well as the problem of what goes on in your factory. How do you get keys from the HDCP key authority to you, to your factory, to your device, and have that entire chain work in a way where ideally the trust is between an offline central, offline key management room, which is locked down where you can manage a central key, all the way through to a core in the chip and with all the stuff in between untrusted. And cryptographically, it's not that hard to do. You can do public keys in a chip, you can build channels, you can do Diffie-Hellman, you can do various kinds of crypto to make it all happen. But actually productizing all this and building the pieces turns out to be a lot of work. but it's one where I'm really optimistic about what this kind of approach will take. I hope more companies, in some ways, will be competing with us, or at least looking at things that can be done here. We just announced a little while ago a huge relationship with Qualcomm, so I'm excited about what we're going to start seeing in mobile devices around, you know, improved security technologies and those, for example. So to wrap up my talk here, I want to look ahead for the end here and go back to this question of sort of what is Moore's Law doing and what does it mean for security? So we have this exponential growth in the number of transistors that Moore's Law is enabling. And when you get twice as much complexity in a product, you actually don't get a product that's twice as good. If I put twice as many processors in a phone, it's not twice as good a phone as I had before because you put the most useful features in first. Likewise, if I double the number of lines of code in Microsoft Word, it's not twice as valuable a product because you put the most important things in first and then there's diminishing returns after that. But RISC doesn't work that way. RISC goes up with your complexity and in many cases faster than with your complexity because of these problems of interactions and bugs that I was talking about earlier. So if we look at this difference between the value of the features and we subtract the risks that we get by putting those features in, we end up with this U-shaped curve where at first we're gaining and then we're losing because the complexity is introducing risks that exceed the value of what we've added to the product. And if we can't keep that value of the products growing, i.e. if we can't keep on the growing part of that red curve, it means we can't make products that are more useful for end users. In other words, the products become less useful because of the features we put in them. And that's a really, really bad thing if you're a product vendor and your product that you made, your new product is less valuable than your old one. And sort of a funny version of this is right after the Snowden leak started coming out, both the Russians and Indians announced they were going to go back to typewriters for some of their sensitive stuff. And the idea that a typewriter is more useful than a computer is kind of bothersome, isn't it, if your company's selling computers. So if we look ahead, what lies in front of us? The macro trend is that for an absolute minimum of 3 to 5 years, security is going to keep getting worse. There is no technology that's going to stop that. There may be individual systems that fare much better, and there will be some that fare much worse than the average. But if you look at it from kind of a population perspective, there is nothing that will come to our rescue possibly within the next 3 to 5 years. And then after that, it's really a question about the things that we're doing today and whether we can come up with things that will make our situation better at the end of that period or whether it's just going to keep on getting worse. But the ability of the technology industry to improve humanity depends on finding solutions. We cannot get the benefits of new technologies to be useful to people if they cause problems that are greater than the solutions that they're aiming to fix. You know, making your air conditioner online so that it can tell the repair company when it's not working correctly has some value, but if the cell network in that air conditioner provides an entree into your home network or your business network and it compromises all of your data, the value of having that repair person be able to come with a little bit less work is not enough to justify that. So the questions about whether the promise of things like the Internet of Things and smart cities will ever be realized fundamentally comes back to a question of whether we can come up with ways to manage the risks that those features will create for us. And so if you know, here's a 1995 Mercedes, Windows 95. Say you stuck that Mercedes online running Windows 95. That car would not be selling today for $15,000, $20,000 on eBay. It would be a car that you would be unwilling to drive. And when we make things like connected cars today, how do we make those products be even as good as the offline component versions that we presently have? And probably what happens follows what's happened in other industries that went from exciting to boring. You know, if you look at aviation, there was an era where getting from point A to point B was the challenge, and it didn't really matter how safe it was because it was just hard enough to make it work. Getting that airplane to fly was a huge challenge. And now if you look at aviation, it's a tremendously boring industry. You can't go and build this new crazy airplane design and start selling tickets on it the next week to customers. You have all sorts of work around safety. And the vast majority of the spending on, for example, building airplanes is really coming from this problem of how to make them safe. Pharmaceuticals are the same. And there was an era where you could come up with any old chemical you wanted, and if it made people feel better, whether it was a placebo effect or whether you stuck some opiates in it, all the better, you could just go sell that stuff. And today it's become a much, much more regulated, much less innovative industry. We've slowed things down. And eventually I think we're going to see that with data security. And I don't say that with excitement. I say it with actually kind of trepidation, because we're in those pioneering days where you can go out and go build some crypto and sell it to customers the next day, and it's really exciting. But the consequences for those customers are not acceptable from a long-term perspective. But to do all of this means we've got to manage those risks, we've got to compartmentalize them, we've got to get sensible security boundaries, we've got to have components that we can trust, and security modules, in whatever forms they take, are going to play a central role in that. So as you're thinking about the problems you're working on here and today, they actually have a really, really big impact. And when you see things that are screwed up and people are building things that don't make sense, fixing those is really important. And it actually goes beyond just whether or not you're going to collect your salary. Because everybody in this room, if you know what you're doing, all of the trends here say job security. That's not your concern. It's about how do we make the world a better place? How do we tackle these issues? And how do we make it so that the technology industry doesn't stall out because we failed to solve these security problems? So that's the end of my talk. Nobody's urging me to get off the stage, so if you want to ask any questions, I can probably stay up here until I get forcibly removed.
Paul, thank you for the illuminating talk. I agree that placing our trust in hardware security modules is a very promising way at, with solving this scale issue with security in general. But solving the problem of trust in hardware also depends on things beyond just installing a key and knowing the company that manufactures the chip. You know, it goes, present day hardware manufacturing involves things like supply chain management. And then most of the chips are not really manufactured in one place. They're assembled from components coming from many, many different places. So in some ways, the problem of trust in hardware is no different than the problem of trust in PKI. It's just a different space, but the scale is kind of similar, at least it seems to me. Do you think we can really get ahead by going that route compared to PKI?
I'm a lot more so PKI can work also. So calling PKI is fundamentally broken is ignoring a lot of questions around how a given PKI is operating and what it's doing and how do you authenticate before you grant credentials and so forth. Digital signatures are something we understand how to do even in a post-quantum cryptography quantum computing world. When it comes to security and chips, there's a question of whether your chip was faithfully manufactured from the mask set that was defined. And the question of backdoors where somebody has taken over the manufacturing facility of the wafers is a relatively hard problem. But it's also one where there are a lot of people who are involved in making sure that chips are made correctly, because the cost of a mask set is in the millions of dollars today if you're looking at a big SoC. So if we put a little asterisk on that question of whether the mask set was actually the one that was used to make the chip, after that, everything is really an engineering problem that we didn't know how to solve. I mean, the question of defining a crypto module that can do crypto correctly and is simple enough that we can deal with the complexity and actually get the bugs out of that little piece, that's a doable problem. The question of how you deal with the factory situation, we know how to do, for example, an ephemeral Diffie-Hellman between our crypto core and appliance. We know how to have the appliance have a key that has been signed through recognize it authentic. We can program keys in through a series of handshakes. You know, in our cores, we'll often program some keys at wafer sort, some keys at package test, some keys at device assembly. So an attacker has to break, in addition, all three of those to get the combined keys that get produced. So again, these are problems where the risk does not go to zero. There are adversaries who, for example, might go and make a different mask set and substitute. Although, again, it's pretty hard to do that in a way where some large number of people won't be aware of it. Compared to where we are today, though, where we're one software bug in giant piles of spaghetti code from failure, it's a very, very different risk profile. So if we ask how do we get from where we are today to a place where it's you don't expect your devices to lose all of its secrets all the time, and to be able to do computations and useful things for us in a way that we actually can have a high expectation of trusting. It's the only path that I see. Not a smooth road, but it's one I'm optimistic about. Yes?
Security is a moving target. We all know it because we all discover vulnerabilities in our software. But the hardware is another, and the silicon is just more of the software implemented in silicon. How do you propose we address security module, hardware security modules, bugs that will inevitably found when now device is not just a line of code and a patch away, but the entire device has to be replaced?
It's a good question. It's one where when you're building hardware, you can build your hardware such that there are no single points of failure. So for example, if I want to encrypt a message, there's no reason I have to only use one key and one hardware block in that. I can have, for example, hardware engine A, B, and C. I can also have some understanding of separation in hardware by understanding where the wires go and what the transistors are doing that gives me an ability to have a certain level of confidence. It is not an easy engineering problem, though. I mean, if you take your average hardware engineer and you say, go build a security thing, the likelihood of failure approaches 100% if they haven't got a lot of background in the area. But if you go build a AES function in hardware and test it reasonably, it's pretty likely you're going to be correctly implementing AES. If you can figure out how to store and program your keys, again, doing the crypto right, it's quite likely you'll get that correct. Verification is certainly a very, very important thing, and we spend way more resources making sure we've done what we think we've done than we do actually doing it. So if I look at where our resources get consumed, it's around gaining that confidence and certainty. We have hardware cores in the field. Our first big customer was a pay TV system that went live in 2002 that went from rampant piracy to basically none. And those chips are still in the field. And pay TV piracy is one where you know if you've been broken, along with payment systems. So data points like that are useful to see. We built that particular design in a way that there weren't single points of failure. So it's possible that some of the security mechanisms broke, but others saved us. I can't answer that question with certainty because all I can see is the sort of ultimate economic question about whether there's a commercial business attacking the systems. But there's a lot of work to do. These are not easy problems. So I don't want to understate them, but I also think that they're not impossible, whereas I think the software security problem is impossible. So I think I've got time for two last questions. Okay, great. Please.
I was just going to mention that a lot of the functionality is being written in high-level VHDL kind of languages, and it's entirely possible to slip in the equivalent of zero-day bugs and other things like that that can be exploited later in the field. So now that we've got, we understand how to maybe do analysis of software code a little better than we understand how to do analysis of those kinds of lines of code for our security functions and others. Do you have anything that is in the works for doing validations that we haven't got 0 days being slipped in intentionally into designs?
There's certain things you can do in hardware that help. So for example, anytime you've got a wire that doesn't toggle in your test suite is something that you want to pay a lot of attention to and you can see in many stages of your design in a chip, which you don't, in software, the idea of a bit that doesn't toggle or you don't understand where it came from, well, there's so many bits everywhere, you can't keep track of them all. Likewise, the code coverage tools and their formal tools that work much better on HDLs because every clock cycle, all of your state synthesizes down to a fixed number of flip-flops, whereas, again, the problem with software state, it just blows up on you very quickly the way software engineers work. The question, though, of how you take that VHDL or Verilog or whatever your HDL is, how you make sure that that matches the spec and then how the final net list that you get matches the VHDL and then the masks match the net list. I mean, each of those steps, there are ways that multiple people can go and check those using independent tools. It doesn't mean that your risk is zero. And the question, if your lead architect is evil, you're going to have a pretty unlikely chance of catching that. But I actually worry more about lead architects being incompetent or incompetence than I do about evil on small design teams. Hardware's better than software, generally, but and if you want to talk offline, I can talk with you about the things that we've done to try to again, reduce those risks, but you never get your risk to zero. But thankfully, we're competing against software systems where the risk is so unbelievably high that we're guaranteed to be much better at the end of the day. Yes, last question, please.
Could you share your view on quantum cryptography since it's very much close to what your interest in hardware security?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question.
Could you share your view on quantum cryptography since it's very close to hardware security you're interested
in? Oh, quantum cryptography?
Yeah, just what do you think? Earlier, Phil was mentioning, you know, we need to think about post-quantum, you know, security and things like that.
Do you mean quantum computing-resistant crypto algorithms, or do you mean quantum key distribution?
Quantum key distribution, for example, yeah.
I think my thoughts match Phil's generally. The problem, I don't want to worry about what the physical layer looks like because I need to be able to communicate with everybody in the world, and I don't have a way to get photons unmolested to everybody in the world. So I need crypto that sits at higher layers. And the problem, that, to be candid, that quantum key distribution solves for me is actually the one problem we've solved pretty well with math. I mean, AES-256 does what we think it does, and all the things that are risky for me in the systems that we're working on, the risk that somebody's going to have a practical attack against AES-256, well, it's not zero. It's borderline the least of my worries. There's so many other things that are much, much more likely to kill us that I'm not worrying so much about that as questions like bugs and software issues and, you know, whether the random number generator is stuck in some way that I'm not going to see, and whether or not the debug mode for my ASIC can be turned on by the attacker because it's got a hardwired JTAG password in it that's the common for all chips, like most chip manufacturers happen to do, and stuff like that, which is kind of down in the sort of gritty reality rather than in the sort of academic physics space. And to some degree, even the quantum computing resistant algorithms, I feel a little bit the same way about it. I mean, I think quantum computing is a really interesting area, but if I actually look at the risks and why things are failing and what we need to do to bring that risk curve down, solving the problems presented by quantum computing, well, it's a really interesting academic exercise, is kind of removed from the reason that, you know, the patients are dying in the streets every single day. And when you go back at looking at the risk curves that we've got, there are some very immediate things that we need that we can do today with the technologies we have today. But it doesn't mean we shouldn't be looking ahead, but it's not what keeps me awake at night. Yeah, Phil, I'll break the rule about the last question because it's Phil. So I think the solution to our long-term problem is one where we're going to have different compute environments for different things. And the big processors for playing Angry Birds will remain the way they are and probably have the same insecurities they have today forever. But you'll have other processors that probably won't be as fast that can talk to the display and have an extra plane, for example, in the graphics pipeline and get the inputs from the users and, you know, do things at an order of magnitude slower, but many orders of magnitude safer than the big processors. And those environments may have attributes like the SGX system Intel's just put out in terms of a philosophy, although probably not the engineering, where you can have an untrusted OS, an untrusted file system, and all of the existing stuff existing the way it is, but add something else in where your more sensitive thing can take place. And the question, Moore's Law will give us the transistors to add that. The question then is, will people use it? And, you know, you'll be on the bleeding edge of adopting this kind of stuff, as will some other applications, like banking applications where you'd like to do an SSL transaction and or build a tunnel and keep the user credential somewhere where the rooted device won't expose it. And then you'll start moving functionality or pieces of functionality out of the main insecure processor over to these better places. And I can see a roadmap of where this can go. It will take time, and there will be bumps in the road, and there will be incompetent engineers who make mistakes along the way, and there will be it'll be confusing for users. So I don't want to make it sound like it's this grand vision where, you know, 4 years from now, you know, we'll be in a dramatically better place. But I think there is a path from where we are to a place where you can have things like secure VoIP happening without depending on any software besides the software you wrote and without depending on any hardware besides pieces that are well inspected, assuming your chip was manufactured faithfully from those netlists. So certainly better than where we are now. Well, thank you very much.